the continuing miracle of Our Lady of Guadalupe. In the 1500s, a Spanish conquistador was a composite man, explorer, soldier, administrator, and carrier of Christianity. In all these qualifications, one man towers above the rest, Hernando Cortés, the conquistador par excellence, who brought Mexico to the political fold of his Spanish king and to the spiritual fold of his heavenly king. But the history books don't tell you that Cortés had a powerful partner in this exploit, none other than the Mother of Christ. Without her partnership, history would certainly read differently, and Cortés would, more or less, have failed. So we'll fill in what the history books leave out. And we'll meet another character, the Indian Juan Diego. He never rates a mention in the history books. Yet he ranks with Cortés and Montezuma in the Epic of Mexico. In 1519, the Cortés expedition set sail from Cuba in a fleet of 11 caravels, small ships like this. They carried 600 men, 16 horses, and 10 cannon. They set sail in a hurry because Cortés had got wind of something. The governor of Cuba was about to revoke the order to sail, so Cortés decided to go before the counter-order could be delivered to him. And, by the way, it's interesting to note that at a later date, when Cortés was confronted by an expedition sent from Cuba to arrest him, first he defeated them, then he persuaded them to join him rather than to arrest him, and that was the sort of fellow he was. Well, then, in 1519, this small fleet landed on the south coast of the Gulf of Mexico. Cortés scuttled nearly all the ships so that he could enlist the crews in his army. Ahead lay the great unknown, but in his wildest dreams, Cortés was not prepared for what he found. He found not a primitive people, but a high civilization, the Aztecs, equal in many respects to European civilization. This Aztec empire stretched from the Atlantic to the Pacific, and from what is now Honduras to what is now New Mexico. The Spaniards found an empire of 9 million, very intelligent people. A complex empire ruled by an emperor, Montezuma, with a system of government that was similar to European government, with a civilized judicial system, with philosophers, astronomers, mathematicians, and builders, with surgeons and medical men, artists, sculptors, and writers, and a religion that was a shocker. As a strategist, Cortés discerned the weakness in the Aztec Empire. It was this. Within the empire, there were several small conquered nations, small nations under the rule of the Aztecs. These conquered nations were unhappy under the rule of the Aztec emperor. But though they were ripe for rebellion against Montezuma, they resisted the advance of the Spaniards. Sometimes the Spaniards were outnumbered 500-1 by fierce and experienced Indian fighters. But the Spaniards believed in the first rule of battle, win it. They not only won the battle, they also won the respect of the defeated Indians. The Indians admired the military tactics and the cool courage of the small Spanish army. And Cortés the Victorious was always Cortés the Chivalrous. He was always generous in victory. The defeated Indian tribes joined Cortés, and they became his loyal allies. To a man like Cortés, religion was central to life, but the religion of the Indians dismayed him, a barbaric affair steeped in human sacrifice, hundreds of human victims by the week, innumerable thousands by the year, to appease their ugly idols. Sacrifices in which the human heart was snatched, still beating, from the victim's body, and the heart held high to appease the gods. The Aztec overlords shared this religion with the subject tribes, and Cortés found that his new allies held prisoners in cages. They were captured Aztec prisoners, being threatened for the next sacrificial day. he set the prisoners free. The Indian towns had temples, temples which were great pyramids of stone, on top of which were wooden structures to house the idols. A great god was Huitzilopochtli, a fierce warrior god and symbol of the sun. He died every evening, but at night he was rejuvenated and was born anew each morning to drive away the dark with his shaft of light. Huitzilopochtli needed plenty of nourishment to keep this activity going, to maintain the cycle of day and night. He needed human blood continually. Another great god was this one, the stone serpent, Quetzalcoatl, a feathered stone serpent, god of life, fertility, art, and other things. He also required human sacrifice, though he was not of so voracious an appetite as Huitzilopochtli. But their combined appetites were substantial. For example, on the accession of one Aztec emperor in 1486, during the celebrations in the capital city, 80,000 human victims were sacrificed. Their hearts were offered to the sun, and their limbs were served at banquets. As Cortes, with Christianity in his bones, saw this thing not as a religion, but as an abomination that had to be eradicated. In the areas he controlled, he had the idols knocked down and temples cleansed. Then, in those pyramid temples, he placed crucifixes and madonnas. But nevertheless, the stone serpent and the sun god kept their tyranny over the Indian mind. So far, the Spanish army had met remarkable success. But the real target lay ahead of them, the heart of the Aztec Empire, where Montezuma ruled. Montezuma's capital city was Tenochtitlan, which is now Mexico City. And Tenochtitlan was a very large city by European standards. A beautiful city, set on an island in a great lake, a lake which has since been drained away. It was a city with streets and canals, like Venice, with thousands of buildings, plastered and painted in pastel colors. When the conquistadores beheld it, they were entranced by its beauty. In the center was a great square where Montezuma's magnificent palace stood, and where also were the lesser palaces of the Aztec nobles. On one side of the square were two huge pyramids. They were the central temples of the Aztec religion. Militarily, Cortes was facing a tough nut to crack. The splendid city, set in the center of vast waterways, was accessible only by narrow causeways, along which not more than four horsemen could ride abreast. Yet, Cortes' soldiers, accompanied by Indian allies, made their way along the narrow causeway to the heart of the city. And surprisingly, Montezuma received them. Montezuma received Cortes because he held Cortes in some awe. He remembered the Aztec legend that a long-dead priest of Quetzalcoatl would someday return, white-skinned and bearded, and take over the empire. And, by the legend's prophecy, the time was due. But Montezuma was plagued by another thought, which history books don't mention. 10 years earlier, his sister, the Princess Papantzin, was laid apparently lifeless in a tomb. But she wasn't lifeless. She was in a coma. She had recovered from the coma in time to be rescued from the tomb. Then the princess told Montezuma of visions. Visions in which she'd stood beside an angel on a seashore and watched great ships approaching. On the sails were black crosses, and on the angel's forehead was a black cross. The angel had told her that these ships were bringing men who would conquer the Aztec nation and would bring to its people knowledge of the true God. The angel promised that the princess would be the first to receive the waters that wash away sins, meaning, of course, baptism. Now Cortes had come, white-skinned and bearded, and with his insignia, a black cross. Montezuma felt himself in the grip of forces beyond him. By the paralysis of Montezuma's will, Cortes had secured a hold on the city without striking a blow. Yet he sensed that Montezuma was quietly planning to drive him out. And characteristically, Cortes took the initiative. He made Montezuma his prisoner and held him at a hostage. He tried to explain the Christian faith to Montezuma. However, Montezuma was not receptive. He took Cortes along to the central temple, where his priests worshipped Huitzilopochtli. The barbarity of it revolted Cortes, and within their own temple he denounced the idols. The priests went pale with anger, and Montezuma cautioned Cortes. Now, a Napoleon or a Caesar might have compromised with the native religion to win the natives politically, but a Cortes could not compromise in religion, and this was religion at its worst. What happened next was Cortes' finest moment. He struck at the great idol Huitzilopochtli and hurled it down the temple steps. The priests raged and Montezuma expostulated while Cortes had the temple cleaned. And on the empty altar he placed a crucifix and a statue of the Madonna. The priests gave notice that Huitzilopochtli would walk out on the Aztec Empire for this insult and would take other gods with them. But crucifix and Madonna remained on the altar for the moment. Eventually the storm burst. The Aztec nation rose up to avenge its gods, and then the Spaniards in the city were really fighting for their lives. Yet Cortes' finest moment continued. He gallantly refused to abandon crucifix and Madonna. He and one of his captains actually fought their way, step by step, up the 100 steps to the top of the pyramid temple. Cortes seized the Madonna and the captain grabbed the crucifix. Then they fought their way down again, step by step, through the swords and the stones of the Aztecs. And only then, with crucifix and Madonna, did Cortes retreat. The terrible retreat of the Spaniards and their Indian allies. The retreat from the capital. The retreat along the narrow causeways in what they called their night of tears. The battered Spanish army finally regrouped about 11 miles from the city, where Cortes placed the Madonna on a low branch of a giant cypress tree, and they all knelt and prayed to Our Lady of Remedies, the Madonna statue that had reigned so briefly in the Aztec temple. As if in answer, the Spaniards found that their Indian allies remained loyal in spite of the disaster. Towns welcomed them and promised them food and supplies and warriors. Now let me interrupt our narrative just to say that the little Madonna disappeared from the record after the Night of Tears. But a few years later, the little statue was found by an Indian farmer, hidden not far from the cypress tree. And Our Lady of Remedies was given a church of her own on a hill nearby. Well, now back to the narrative. Cortes' army regained the initiative and recaptured Montezuma's capital. Montezuma made peace. He accepted Charles V of Spain as his overlord. And a year later, in 1520, during a riot, Montezuma was killed. First one nephew, then another nephew succeeded him, and they each renewed the war against the Spaniards. Finally, in a 93-day siege and a campaign house by house, temple by temple, Cortes again captured the city. And he took prisoner the new emperor in 1561, only a year after Montezuma's death. With that, the great Aztec Empire passed into history, and the nation of Mexico became part of the Holy Roman Empire as an equal partner under the Spanish King Charles V. But yet, and still, the demoniacal religion persisted in its domination of the Indians, and almost all the Indians stubbornly resisted the new Christianity. They didn't want Christianity, most of them. The Spaniards demolished the temple of Huitzilopochtli, and they used the materials to build the Church of Santiago on the base where the pyramid had stood. The old church still stands there today, on the base of the pyramid, with modern buildings around it. The first Indian converts to Christianity were baptized in this old church, which of course was then new. And among the first converts was the Princess Papantzin. And thus was fulfilled the promise that she'd received in her prophetic vision 15 years earlier, when she'd been told that she would be the first to receive the waters that wash away sin. And the princess took the name, the Christian name, Donna Maria. Another person in that first group was a middle-class Aztec citizen with an unpronounceable name, and he took the Christian name Juan Diego. With him were his uncle and his wife. So this Juan Diego is now about to become our central character, our unlikely hero. Now that the Indians had become part of the Spanish Empire, steps were taken to educate them and to Christianize them. Their culture was fused with European culture to build a new nation, which is now Mexico. At this time, much hung in the balance. Perhaps the whole new world hung in the balance. If the Spaniards had failed in Mexico, the other colonial movements which civilized the new world might never have taken place. And the Spaniards very nearly did fail in Mexico. Because after the conquest, some cruel administrators followed Cortes, and within 10 years, the Indians were at the point of revolt, and they were then capable of annihilating every European in their land. But the uprising never happened. Instead, in a short time, Indians and Spaniards were united politically and religiously. Now, how did it happen, and why did it happen? Again, we have to bypass the history book.
In 1531, the Blessed Virgin came personally. She came to a spot near the capital, now Mexico City. She came to the exact geographical center of the Americas. She was coming not just for Mexico, but for the Americas, the New World. The Indians generally wanted nothing to do with the new Christianity. The missionaries had been having a lean time. There'd been very few converts, but among that few was our hero, Juan Diego. On a Saturday morning, December the 9th, 1531, he was walking in open country on his way to attend a special Mass for the Blessed Virgin. He heard music, heavenly music, coming from Tepeyac Hill. Puzzled, he looked towards the top of the little hill where the dawn was breaking. Suddenly the singing ceased, and in the silence he heard his name called. He felt no fear, but with a strange joy he climbed the hill. And there he saw a lady of superhuman magnificence. Her garments radiated light, so that the stony ground shone like a rainbow. Even the miserable bushes were glittering. Juan Diego knelt, and the lady spoke in a gentle voice. The words sound quaint to us, but in their conversation, she and Juan Diego used the native idiom for conveying both affection and esteem. Her first words were, "Juanito, the smallest of my children, where are you going?" And he answered, "My lady and my child, I must go to your house in Mexico, Tlatelolco." The lady went on in a long speech, which I must abbreviate. She said, "Be it known and understood by you, the smallest of my children, that I am the ever-Virgin Holy Mary, Mother of the True God. I ardently desire that a temple be built for me here, where I can show and offer all my love and protection, for I am your merciful mother. I wish to hear and help you and all those who dwell in this land, and all those others who love me." The lady bade Juan Diego to go to the bishop and tell him of her wish that a temple be built.